Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop update on thyroid cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and I do want to call out to the thyroid cancer organizations that have really worked very hard to spread the word about the program today. So the American Thyroid Association, Light of Life Foundation, and ThyK, Thyroid Cancer Survivors Association. I have to say that, and because of all of the collaboration effort to reach out to all of you and your interest in the program today, we have over 528 participants on the call today. So this is a very large group. And you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Algeria, Canada, China, Costa Rica, France, India, Mexico, New Zealand, Serbia, and the United Kingdom. So this is really a great global call and a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Today's program is supported by ISI Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mona Sabra. And Dr. Sabra is attending physician, endocrinology service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, member American Thyroid Association, ATA, and Endocrine Society, past chair, American Thyroid Association Clinical Affairs Committee. And Dr. Sabra is going to present an overview of thyroid cancer, diagnosing and staging, treatment options, and novel approaches to treat refractory thyroid disease, the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Sabra.
Hello, everyone. I would like to welcome you to this program, and it's a pleasure to be here with you today. As Carol has said, I am going to be talking to you about an overview on thyroid cancer types, diagnosis, treatments, and any novel approaches to the treatment of thyroid cancer. So before we start, let's talk a little bit about how often we see thyroid cancer in clinics. This is a disease that is now being more commonly diagnosed than it was in the prior years, and part of that is because we are doing more imaging tests and more neck imaging tests, and therefore are able to diagnose more thyroid nodules and ultimately are able to diagnose more thyroid cancer. That makes thyroid cancer the number 8 most common cancer among all different cancers, and it is usually frequently diagnosed in women between the ages of 30 to 65. Now, the good news about thyroid cancer is that the majority of the patients, and it's around 98% of the patients, will survive thyroid cancer and will do very well with thyroid cancer. But if death usually occurs from thyroid cancer later in the process of the disease, usually occurs in older patients and usually occurs in patients who are aged between 60 to 80 years. Now, we can turn a little bit to the different types of thyroid cancer that we have. And the most common type of thyroid cancer that you probably have heard of is papillary thyroid carcinoma, which is usually seen in around 80 to 85% of the cases. The second most common type of thyroid cancer is also called follicular thyroid cancer, which is around seen in around 12 to 15% of the cases. And a very rare form of thyroid cancer is called anaplastic thyroid carcinoma or undifferentiated thyroid cancer, which is usually seen in less than 3% of the cases. The difference between papillary and follicular thyroid carcinoma, they usually vary. Both of them are very well-behaved tumors, and both of them are treated the same way, even though they vary a little bit on the biologic makeup of these different tumors. The anaplastic thyroid cancer is called undifferentiated because it's poorly behaved. It usually progresses very quickly. It usually causes it has a very high risk of causing death and in a short period of time. But luckily, this is a disease that is very rare and only seen in less than 3% of the cases. Now, there are some other form of thyroid cancer. One of them is called medullary thyroid cancer. And this is a disease that can be familial, meaning it runs in families. It can also be associated with other hormonal problems, including calcium problems and adrenal problems. And another rare form of thyroid cancer is when patients develop with lymphoma inside of a thyroid. Other types of cancers in the thyroid could be metastasis from other cancers coming from either the colon, the breast, the kidney, and sometimes skin cancer like melanoma can also present as a mass in the thyroid. But these are usually rare presentations of cancer in the thyroid. Now, the way that we diagnose thyroid cancer, in most of the cases, it is usually discovered by chance or incidentally, where the patient is having an imaging test to the neck for some other reason, and a nodule is usually seen. After a nodule is diagnosed, usually an ultrasound is obtained, and the ultrasound should include both a view of the thyroid itself and the whole neck to be able to make sure that there is no spread to the lymph node. And if a suspicious nodule is seen in the thyroid or a suspicious lymph node is seen, usually a biopsy is ordered, and then a diagnosis of either thyroid cancer or suspicion for thyroid cancer is made. Once we have that diagnosis, usually the patient is sent to a surgeon, as surgery is the primary mode of treatment for patients with differentiated thyroid cancer. The type of the surgery, whether it's going to remove the half of a thyroid or the full thyroid, or include also a lymph node removal, it is dependent on the size of the tumor, where is it, whether it is in one lobe or is it in two lobes, whether it's already spread to lymph nodes or not. And that decision is usually made between the patient and the surgeon, and it's also based on the information that is usually gathered before the patient gets to see the surgeon. After the surgery, usually the patient is seen by an endocrinologist, usually around six weeks after the surgery. And at that time, we review the results of the surgery, including the pathology report and also the marker of the cancer in the blood. And based on that information, a decision is made regarding two important questions. The first question is, what is the chance of the cancer coming back in the future? And the second question is, what is the chance that the patient is going to have a bad outcome, meaning die from their disease? And based on those two important questions, we sort of classify the patients who have thyroid cancer in one of three different categories based on the American Thyroid Association and other staging systems. If the patient is considered to have a low-risk cancer, usually no further treatment are offered, and therefore the patient would not benefit from having radioactive iodine treatment. However, if a patient falls into the high-risk category, then radioactive iodine is felt to improve the odds of the patient on the long term and is usually given to the patient. When a patient falls in the intermediate risk, there is no clear evidence that the radioactive iodine is going to work, but we're not even sure that it's not going to work either because there are no enough studies to be able to prove for or against that treatment. And in these situations, the decision is made between the patient and the physician regarding the proper way to follow to treat the disease, whether we're going to continue with surveillance or whether we're going to give a small dose of radioactive iodine, even though we're not really sure whether it's going to be of benefit to the patient. After the treatment is usually offered, part of the treatment, the patient is usually placed on thyroid hormone, and the dose of the thyroid hormone is going to be dependent on the patient's risks, but also on the patient's symptoms and the blood test that is usually obtained to titrate the dose to a certain level. After the treatment is offered, usually the patient is followed every 6 months to a year, and at every visit, we restage the patient and we reassess those risks regarding what chance for the cancer to come back in the future, and what is the chance of having a bad outcome. So those initial risks that I talked to you about in the future, in the beginning, are not they're not static. They usually change over time. So if the patient continues to do well, then the risks usually go down over time. If the patient comes back with a recurrence, then those risks obviously are going to go up. If the cancer comes back, then there are multiple treatments that can be offered, including surgery. We can give another dose of radioactive iodine. We can give also some other treatments. At one point in time, some cancers become unresponsive to radioactive iron. And the question at that time is what to do to manage the cancer and to prevent any further progression or spread of the cancer. If the cancer is not responsive to the iodine, but it is not growing, usually we do observe the patients. However, if the cancer is growing over time, there are now some new biological treatments that can be offered to patients who have to try to slow down the growth of the cancer over time. This is also to assume that there's no other treatments that can be offered, local treatments such as radiation, surgery, that may have any better benefit to the patient than those biological agents. Those biological agents are called the multikinase inhibitors. They have been shown to slow the growth of the cancer, but they also come with certain side effects, so it's always a good idea to actually balance the benefits and the risks of these drugs before we actually put the patient on those medications. And more importantly, as you can hear, the decision to treat thyroid cancer is a very complex decision, and it's not a decision that the physician makes alone. This is a decision that is actually a shared decision between the patient and the physician, and all the physicians involved in the care of the patient. So it's very important for the patients to actually voice any concerns that they have, any side effects that they have of the treatment, and to be an active participant into the decision-making on how they are going to be treated for their thyroid cancer. And I think this is all I have.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. Saber. That was really excellent and very informative for everyone in terms of the treatment of thyroid cancer and also refractory thyroid cancer as well. And, of course, so we appreciate that and look forward to questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Christoph Masikowitz. Dr. Masikowitz is Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology, and Medical Oncology, Assistant Professor of Otolaryngology, Tisch Cancer Institute, ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, Mount Sinai Hospital. And Dr. Masikowitz is going to present on clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, and managing treatment side effects and discomfort. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Masikowitz.
So hello. For me, it's a good afternoon. I'm in New York, so I know that we have people from all over the world, so it's a little bit overwhelming to have such a large audience. So I'm going to cover the clinical trials in thyroid cancer. So in general, I want to say that cancer clinical trials are no longer seen as the last resort for cancer patients who had no other treatment choices. Today, patients often choose to receive their first treatment for cancer in the form of the clinical trial for many reasons. Cancer patients who take part in a trial may be held by the treatment they receive. Trial participants receive either the standard of care, which scientists consider the most effective at the time, and known treatment that is eventually available at the time, or the new medication. Cancer trial participants have access to the latest drugs and forms of the treatment that otherwise are not commercially available or available to our patients. Although there is no guarantee that the new treatment will be effective, many trial participants conclude that the possible benefits outweigh the risk. And if the new treatment is effective, patients in clinical trials are among the first to receive it. Clinical trials contribute to overall knowledge and progress against cancer. Many of today's standard treatments for cancer begin in clinical trials. In fact, cancer clinical trials have helped establish the effectiveness of sorafenib and lenvatinib. Those are the two drugs that have been recently approved by the FDA in management of the thyroid cancer. Many people treated for cancer are now living longer thanks to the knowledge gained through those clinical trials. Many patients like you had decided to be part of the sorafenib and lenvatinib trials, and not only they benefit from those new drugs, otherwise would be not available to them at that time, and now the knowledge is helping us to help you in the treatment of thyroid cancer. We know that the cancer can be a terrifying diagnosis, and taking an active part in your cancer treatment and knowing that you might be helping to find a cure by enrolling in a trial can be an empowering experience. Patients often fear about experimental treatments, placebos, unnecessary testing, cost of care, and access are among barriers and fears in terms of the enrollment in clinical trials. But many of those fears are unfounded, and are strong enough in general population to slow down the pace of the cancer research. And I can give you a few examples. Many times I hear the concern that maybe health insurance will not cover the cost of the clinical trial, and which is not true. Many insurance covers the normal cost of the treatment on cancer clinical trials, and many states have mandatory coverage. In addition, many of the trials are sponsored by big pharma companies, and whatever insurance will not cover will be covered by those big pharma companies. So I don't think so that the cost is an obstacle or concern for patients that they're considering participation in clinical trials. Sometimes patients on Medicare, they're afraid that Medicare will not cover. And it's not true either. Medicare has covering this cost since June of 2000. The other concern that I hear many times that informed consent is meant primarily to protect the legal interests of researchers or maybe big pharma. And it's not true either. The purpose of the informed consent is to protect you and to give you the information about the trial. So let me give you a few examples. Before 2013, we only had strong but very toxic chemotherapy for treatment of thyroid cancer. Nobody wanted to use it. Most of the doctors, they didn't like it because it was very toxic, and patients, they didn't want to receive it because of the toxicity concerns. And it was in 2013 that we got the pill, sorafenib, that I mentioned before, that made patients to live longer. In 2015, we got Lenvima. This is the second one that was approved by the FDA, and it showed to be effective in treatment of the thyroid cancer, and both previously tested in clinical trials. Both trials had approximately 400 patients. That means that those patients, they decided, instead of getting toxic chemotherapy or no treatment at all, to try this new promising therapy, and most of them, they benefited from this. So we have many innovative therapies for thyroid cancer right now. We have added pill and tablets, we call them TKI or kinase inhibitors, as mentioned before. And many times those tablets are customized to your needs. Many times we do those sophisticated testing, we call them genetic testing. We want to find certain mutations that you may have, and we're trying to target them with the specific drugs. And I'm going to give you a little bit of the metaphoric explanation. How do they work? You can think of cancer as a room that has multiple doors, and we doctors, we're trying to close and lock all of them. But each door has a different individual lock. And obviously, key that we use has to match, in this case, it's a tablet or pill, mentioned sorafenib or lenvatinib, may close only half of those doors. And obviously, sometimes the cancer, even if you're going to close half of them, cancer can escape and kind of get out using the other doors. And it is our job to close all of them. So many times we're looking for those more sophisticated, more individualized treatments that not only they're going to close the door, but also lock them, because we want to keep the cancer in check. Sometimes we have to use multiple medication. It's sort of like using set of keys that obviously we want to lock all the doors. So you're going to see many clinical trials in which you're going to see those tablets given in the monotherapy as a single agent. And maybe this is like one master key that can close as many doors as we can think of. Sometimes we give them in combinations because obviously sometimes it takes two sets of keys to close those doors. And I would strongly encourage you to participate in them. The other form of the treatment that is getting so much publicity is called immunotherapy, and those results are very promising in other cancers, such as melanoma, lung cancer, bladder cancers. In those, this immunotherapy is FDA-approved, and now it's slowly being tested in thyroid cancer. With immunotherapy, instead of poisoning your cancer with medications, we're asking your own body to destroy the cancer, as we do it when we get a cold or some kind of infection. The problem is that when we get infection, some kind of a virus or bug, those are easily recognized by our body as foreign. They don't belong to us. With cancer, our body is kind of confused or tricked. Our body thinks that the cancer belongs to us, and basically the immune system cannot fight it. So what immunotherapy, what it does, makes your cancer recognizable, makes your cancer visible, so your own immune system can fight it and maybe win this battle. Sometimes some of those trials, they combine those two options. Sometimes we give the pill that I mentioned, the lock and the door, and sometimes it has to be combined with immunotherapies. And those are available to you as well, and you have to ask your local doctors. All those treatments have side effects, standard and experimental. And it is our doctor's job to find a treatment that's going to fit you, but not just the treatment, but also the dose. We're all different, and we have different tolerance for medications, so don't be afraid to talk to your doctor about side effects. Early intervention to protect you from the severe side effects can have tremendous consequences. Sometimes we can just stop the drug for a few days. Sometimes we can dose reduce, just give you the lower dose. Or sometimes we can give you some other medications to treat those side effects. And I'm going to give you a few examples. Some of those pills or tablets that we use in treatment of thyroid cancer, standard and experimental, can cause high blood pressure. And sometimes the blood pressure can really go high. What we can do, we can give you stronger blood pressure medications. Sometimes patients, they can develop like blisters on their hands. What we can do, we can stop the medicine for a few days, let your body to heal, and then resume the drug at the lower dose. So oftentimes I tell my patients that please call me immediately when you're going to get your side effect. Please don't make any decision quickly that you don't want to continue with this medicine, because we can find a dose that's going to be good for you and you can still benefit it. So you have to be in the close contact. The other side effects are typical, such as diarrhea, muscle pain, joint pain, and those can be treated with dose reduction and eventually just giving you the vacation. When it comes to immunotherapy, the side effects that we always see, those are chills, sometimes shortness of breath, and diarrhea, and it's extremely critical for you to get in touch with your physicians, because when we're going to intervene very early, then obviously we can control those side effects. When it's going to be a little bit later, then it becomes much harder. So overall, I think it is our job, physicians, to find the clinical trial or treatment that's going to fit your needs. And obviously, I strongly encourage you to talk to your local physician or even an expert if you have the access to big academic place, if there is any access or if they have any clinical trials, and they're going to be able to help you to sort it out which of them is best for you. So I want to thank you all for your attention. I want to thank if you have any patients already participate in clinical trials, I want to thank you for your participation. But for the rest that they're considering, I would strongly encourage you to talk to your physicians and strongly consider your participation so we can help each other and we can all gain from this knowledge. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Misikowicz. That was really wonderful, very outstanding. And I think there are a number of takeaways that you said, lots actually. But the concept of the key and the locks, that's something that people can hold on to and remember. And also the way of managing all the different side effects that can come up, that there are treatments for them, and so that people can talk with their healthcare team to get that help. So thank you for making that very clear and many other things clear today. So, and I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. Ms. Bearden is a dietitian. She supervises clinical nutrition at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation, addressing nutritional concerns in the presence of thyroid cancer. Nutrition and hydration are key to the tolerance to treatment. They help provide you the energy to do the things you enjoy and help you also with just your overall well-being, feeling better and healing from treatment. A plant-based diet is the most ideal for prevention, even those during treatment, and in survivorship. A plant-based diet translates into having about two-thirds of your plate coming from a plant-based food. And these plant-based foods are things like whole grains, the least refined the better, fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds. Plant-based foods are important because they provide us antioxidants, fiber, and phytochemicals, all the important nutrients that we need for our body to function optimally. We also know getting these nutrients from your foods are better absorbed in our body than taking them from supplements. So eating a well-balanced diet, incorporating these types of foods is important for everybody. The other third of your plate should focus more on the lean protein. This can come from wild-caught fish, poultry, or even beans. We actually encourage doing entire plant-based meals. It provides an overall health benefit. There's lower sodium, lower processing of foods, less saturated fats, which is important for our overall health as well. But protein is the building block for healing. And if you're going through treatment, if it's radiation or surgery, healing is important. And so having the protein available is necessary. When you're selecting your plant-based foods, fresh or frozen are the best forms. They're the least processed and actually frozen superior. They're picked at their peak, they're washed, they're cut, they're ready to go. There may be a need for you to take supplements due to your unique circumstances to meet your overall health care needs. So talk with your doctor about that. If they do encourage you to take those and direct you to do so, please do. It's part of your treatment and it's important. There may be times in your treatment you have to modify your diet. Like we heard earlier, during special treatment processes, you may experience side effects and may need to make those changes. Always keep in close communication with your healthcare team. Telling them about those side effects sooner rather than later is always better. Dehydration can actually increase nausea, fatigue, make you feel dizzy, provide result in headaches. So fluid is very important, and fluid is actually anything that's liquid at room temperature, water, juice, sports drinks. But a general guideline is for most people, we need about 8 to 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid per day. If you are experiencing side effects, like we heard earlier, possibly diarrhea or even constipation, making sure you're getting enough fluid in is very important, but also communicating with your healthcare team as it might be a side effect. If you are experiencing side effects, keeping a daily food record can also be helpful. It can give us some idea on what you're consuming and then help make your needs and meeting your needs is your unique situation based on what you're experiencing. But a dietitian is there to provide you with that support and direction. They can also provide you general information. Patients are often interested in, like, how many calories do I need today? How much protein do I need today? And then also about the fluid needs. So reaching out to your team, being in communication with all of them is very important. That concludes my portion. Thank you, Carolyn, for allowing me to be a part of today's workshop, and I'm going to pass this back over to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Garden. That was outstanding, very informative, and I know there were questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Kelly. Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker. She is our older adult program coordinator at Cancer Care, and Ms. Kelly is going to address with all of you Cancer Care's pre-psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's now my pleasure to give this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care and have worked with many people who are diagnosed with thyroid cancer and their loved ones. And we've been talking today about your care, really managing your care and quality of life, or as Dr. Sabra said, being an active participant in your care. And I'd like to speak about the importance of creating a support network as part of that care and how cancer care can be a part of your overall network. So a little about us. We're a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We do that in New York face-to-face, and then nationally we do that over the phone. We have support groups, which we also do face-to-face in New York, and we do them over the phone nationally and online, both nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one that we're on today. We provide practical help. We can help you navigate the healthcare system. We also provide some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and they're completely free of charge. And an oncology social worker really is trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, so really how it affects the support network. We're also trained to help patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and overall psychological impact in care. And adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis in the areas I just mentioned is an important part of the healing process, and I actually consider it to be a part of treatment. As you know, cancer affects the whole person, and it affects the whole support network. And we're really here to help guide individuals and families through that. Asking for help, whether it's joining a support group or contacting a social worker for counseling, is a strength. I really want you to know you don't have to do this alone. Joining a support group, you know, you're able to talk with others who are going through a similar situation, or maybe they're experiencing similar problems. With individual counseling, you have a space that's yours to voice any concerns and navigate any of the issues I mentioned earlier. And again, I find the connections really help. They lessen the isolation that many people who are going through this experience, and feeling well emotionally helps you better deal with the diagnosis. At this time, I'm just going to kind of give you a very brief overview of some of the services we have right now. We currently have an online support group for patients who are diagnosed with thyroid cancer. These are great. You have access to them 24/7. They're active groups, and you'll find other patients in there posting, and so it's a really great way to get support. We also provide both general patient and caregiver groups face-to-face in the New York area, over the phone nationally, and we also have those groups online. So I just wanted to let you know about that. And then I also wanted to let you know about a program called Magnolia Meals at Home. And Magnolia Meals is a program that delivers nutritious meals at no cost to patients living with thyroid cancer and their families. It's sponsored by ASI, and it aims to really ease the burden on families by eliminating the need to prepare meals. And that way, you know, loved ones and family members can spend more quality time together. Currently, the program is available in New Jersey, in Bergen, Essex, and some towns in Passaic counties. In New York, in Westchester and Rockland counties, the program is also available in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and the Raleigh-Durham area of North Carolina. So the easiest thing to do to see if you're living in a covered area is to go to the website, and that's www.magnoliameals.com. And on that website, you can just put in your zip code, and it'll tell you if you're in an area that's covered. You can also call us, and I'm going to give you that information now. So, you know, for the Magnolia Meals, or if you're interested in any of cancer care services, call our Hopeline, and that's 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. You can also visit our website, which is www.cancercare.org. And our website is very comprehensive. You're going to find a lot of information, not just on the support services, but on all of our programs, as well as on your diagnosis, treatment, and just ways of coping as you go through this. You know, we've got a lot of really good information from today's program, but it's also a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Just know that we're here to help you understand what it means for you and your loved ones. If you have any questions about today's workshop or our services, don't hesitate to contact us. And lastly, I just want to say again that you're not alone in this. You don't have to walk the path alone. Our services are here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Sarah. That was really wonderful. Just an outstanding presentation and a wonderful call out to the Magnolia Meals program, which is something that many of you might like to take advantage of. So just a great program. Well, now we do have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. So I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to let you know how to queue up and ask questions. We already have a few questions coming in online, but Candace will give you all a chance to know how to ask questions, and then we'll take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get your question at the end of the call, I'll explain to you how to get your questions answered. So, Candace.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question at this time, please press star one.
So we have a question for one of our online participants. And this question, I'm going to direct to Dr. Misikowicz. Mm-hmm. I was told by my endocrinologist that I am suppressed where he wants me to be, and my TSH is where he wants it. But I feel extremely hypo in that I have no energy lost here. Any advice? So if you could address this question in a general way, Dr. Misikowitz, in terms of the question here.
Yes. I mean, obviously, this is something that obviously, overall, this is what I would say. I think all of us, doctors, we work in the multidisciplinary fashion, meaning that it's not just one doctor who is in charge of the whole process. And obviously, I think sharing this information not only with your endocrinologist and raising your concern, obviously, you can share it with the other doctor. And obviously, we can have what we call it a brainstorm. I think when it comes to the suppression, it's a balance. Obviously, on one hand, we know that if we're going to be more aggressive in terms of the suppression, potentially there is a benefit in the way that obviously we're suppressing your potential growth of your cancer. But it, on the other hand, it comes at the cost of the side effects. And sometimes when patients, they have some underlying problems, let's say heart problems, history of heart attacks, in which we cannot be as aggressive. And this is what I do, even if not just with the suppression. This is, has to be the open conversation. And I always strongly encourage not only you, but also the physicians, if we have anyone obviously on this call, to kind of have this open dialogue, because obviously you have to raise your concern to your physician, and obviously they have to be able to address it, because obviously you're a patient. So I would say the only way to solve this problem is just to raise your question, I mean, obviously address your question to your physician, and it should be able to adjust it. So I think this is the only way to handle this.
Excellent. And Dr. Sauber, do you want to add anything to that?
So, yeah, it's not uncommon for patients to feel fatigued after they've had thyroid surgeries, and sometimes this may be related to the dose of the thyroid medication that they are on. Sometimes it may be helped by a change of the preparation of the medication that they are on, and sometimes the cause could be completely different that is not related to the thyroid function, and such as problems in vitamin D levels, problems with anemia, problems with cortisol levels, and some other disorders that need to be taken looked at before we can say all of the lack of energy is related to the thyroid function. So it would be, as Dr. Minkowitz said, it's a good idea to actually discuss those concerns with the doctor and to see if there's any other causes for the reason of her symptoms, and to try to look for those causes and make sure that what can be corrected would be corrected.
Thank you both. Thank you. And we have a telephone question, I believe, Candace?
We have a question from the line of Lori B. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Lori at Lucy Kirchhey Cancer Center, and I have a group member here who is wanting to know what would be some of the signs and symptoms of thyroid cancer.
Well, that's an excellent question. Dr. Sabra, would you like to address that question?
So many patients with thyroid cancer would not have any symptoms. And as I said, the thyroid cancer may be discovered incidentally because they were having an imaging test for something else and a nodule is discovered. Or sometimes they come into the doctors for a routine examination and a nodule is also discovered by exam. In very rare cases, they would be massaging their neck for some other reasons or putting cream on their neck, and they can feel a lump in their neck area, and that would be a common also presenting way for them to present to the doctor. Very rarely, when the nodules in the thyroid are large enough and they're close to the periphery, they can sometimes affect the nerve that affects the vocal cords, and some patients may present with a change in your voice, and very rarely they can also present with an inability to swallow. And this is usually only seen when the cancer is really large and rather than in small cancers.
And Dr. Misikowitz, did you want to add anything to
that? It was pretty comprehensive. Yeah, those are the typical, you know, symptoms and complaints that we see. But most of the time, those patients are being examined by primary physician, and those are incidental findings.
Okay. And our next question from one of our online participants, Dr. Misikowitz, if you could address this question.
Sure.
I'm curious about thoughts on iodine insufficiency and supplementation in treatment of thyroid cancer after lobectomy for small 6-millimeter papillary cancer, no lymph or vascular invasion, low risk category. And again, if Dr. Misikowitz, if you could answer this question in a general way, and then we will invite the person asking the question to go back to the treating healthcare team with the general information you're providing. So.
Yes, so obviously those are the questions that obviously they have to be discussed with the surgeon. So obviously, many times what we do, obviously we do recommend total side radectomy rather than lobectomy, but it's obviously it's based on the individual clinical criteria. In general, so obviously this is what we recommend, and obviously after the treatment with radioactive iodine. So, but it's also dependent on the individual factors.
And Dr. Sauber, did you want to add anything? Or?
I don't have anything to add for this question.
Excellent. Okay. And we have another question. From another caller for Dr. Sabra. I have anaplastic thyroid cancer. I am a year and a half out of surgery, chemo, and radiation. I have meth to the liver. What is the latest approach to addressing anaplastic thyroid cancer?
This is the best approach to actually, the best question to actually to ask the oncologist who's actually taking care of her anaplastic thyroid carcinoma, especially that I'm not really familiar with the type of treatment that she really received so far and the kind of response that she actually had to that treatment. In general, the treatment for anaplastic thyroid carcinoma involves first the local control of the disease, which has to do with the neck involvement of the anaplastic thyroid carcinoma and making sure that it does not lead to an obstruction of the airway and an obstruction of the food pipe and the ability for the patient to breathe. The second aspect that we address is, especially if the disease has spread beyond the neck area, is and usually to the lungs or the liver, then chemotherapy, which is often given, and there are some clinical trials that have been used recently, some with varying success, that she would need to speak to her oncologist about and see what she would qualify for at this stage.
I totally agree. So so usually the approach that we have, because the first thing I would say, the time is the key. This is unfortunately one of the fast-growing cancers, so obviously it has to be addressed almost immediately. So the treatment is many times aggressive, so in which we often give a chemotherapy and radiation alone to the neck to try to control the disease, and especially because we have those two pipes that deliver the oxygen to food, so we have to kind of control the disease. So this is one approach. And obviously, if the patient has systemic disease in which the patient has metastases, we use chemotherapy. But I have to say, and I'm pretty excited, this is kind of in the sense of the talk that I had, that we have new medications, and one of them is Lenvima that is being tested in anaplastic thyroid. And I have to say that historically, we didn't have so many successful treatment in anaplastic thyroid. This one looks promising, so I would strongly encourage the patient to participate in a clinical trial, because I think it looks still more promising than the chemotherapy. There is some talks about the role of immunotherapy in those patients, but again, there is no data, but obviously I would still encourage the patient, and I think there are many trials, even if they're not designed primarily for anaplastic thyroid, we call those trials phase one for all comers, that regardless of the type of cancer that you have, we would still enroll you. So I think this is the best way to approach this kind of cancer. But again, the time is a key, and I would encourage you to look for the medical attention as soon as possible.
Oh, thank you very much. And this question we had a discussion about this actually before the call started. So this is going to involve a multidisciplinary team. It's a question about weight gain. I'm going to ask Dr. Sabra and Dr. Misikwitz if you could address it initially, and then, of course, Ms. Bearden. I have to keep weight on. What can I do to ensure I have enough calories? A plant-based diet seems to be low in calories. So, again, I'm going to ask our medical oncologist to address the question in a general way, because obviously they don't have all the specifics of the situation, but they do have enough information to know that you're concerned about weight loss and the kinds of questions you might want to ask your healthcare team. And then we'll have Ms. Bearden make some recommendations just about things one can do or discuss with the dietitian in your setting. So Dr.
Sure.
Zip, let's start with that.
Sure. So, I mean, obviously, as a medical oncologist, so you know, the patients that I do see, obviously, are the ones that many times they have already, the disease cannot be addressed radioactive iodine. those are the typical patients that they do see. And it doesn't mean that they have to be treated. And they have many of them that they watch, and it's called active surveillance, and at some point we make a decision about a treatment. But when we make those decisions, one of the medication that we use in treatment of the thyroid cancer, it's lenvatinib. And one of the side effects of lenvatinib is the weight loss. And it is a serious concern, because obviously when we think about the weight loss, obviously we think about the fat tissue loss. Obviously, you know, in the general statement, we can be happy, we're losing weight, but sometimes it's a protein weight loss. So it basically, essentially, it's a muscle wasting. And this is something that we don't like, because obviously we need our muscles, because they contribute to our performance status, so what we can do. So for me, it is very important. And when it comes to the treatment, I strongly encourage my patients to obviously eat properly, and I have a dietitian who kind of works with us, but also to be active, because obviously we don't want to create a situation in which the patient can have the excellent performance status and, you know, have the normal life and convert this patient to a patient who can barely walk. So it is extremely important. I wouldn't trivialize this problem, and this is something that has to be addressed, obviously, with the treating physician. Obviously, there are some other reasons that Dr. Sabra Plovici will cover them, but this is the main one that I would see. The other thing is that I would strongly obviously address that obviously weight loss is something that can disqualify the patient from the clinical trial. So obviously it has to be addressed, because obviously then there is more treatment options that can be obviously available to those patients. So there are some other reasons. They can be depression. There are some other reasons that are not directly related to the thyroid cancer, the treatment per se, and they have to be excluded. But the one that I mentioned was obviously related to the drug that we use called Lenvima.
And Ms. Bearden, do you want to address just things that people can do and even ask their physicians or the dietitian in their setting about in terms of
sure. So, I mean, I think in most, I think, you know, I don't know how it is in community, but obviously in the academic settings, yes, we have dietitians that are trained. So obviously, yes, it's a multidisciplinary approach. There are some, you know, pharmacologic intervention that we have, like appetite stimulants. So yes, but obviously we have to exclude other causes. So the treatment has to be very targeted. So we know what is the reason, and obviously we can address it.
And Ms. Bearden, did you want to address just issues that people can do and bring it to the healthcare team about when they are losing weight, but then things that a dietitian might recommend in collaboration with the oncologist about indeed the things that can be done to enhance their weight?
Absolutely. I think from a diet perspective, the most important thing is to keep a food diary. Be mindful of portion sizes. And, you know, a plant-based diet, I know it seems like it could be a lower-calorie diet, but actually plant-based foods can be very calorically dense. So it might be a simple change as focusing on bringing in some different foods, such as nuts and seeds, avocados. They're incredibly calorically dense, but they bring healthy fats, phytochemicals, important nutrients, and vitamins and minerals. We also, you know, bring in the protein, just like we heard about muscle mass. When we lose weight very quickly, what we tend to lose is muscle over fat. And so that's going to impact your endurance. It's going to impact your quality of life. And potentially weight changes can impact your eligibility for further treatment. So talking with your dietitian, she can work with you on making those unique suggestions to meet your nutritional goals, talk with you about calories and protein and portion sizes. But the diet recall or the diet record is really the most helpful when it comes to a dietitian, because sometimes our perceptions are off, and using measuring cups when you're serving yourself is very helpful to get an actual record of what you're consuming. So those are some things that you could try.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks. And we do have a telephone question now. So, Candace?
We have another question from the line of Lori B. Your line is now open.
Yes, I would like to ask a question.
Yes.
In 1970, I had half of a half of my one lobe of the thyroid removed. And this was done at the University of Michigan, and they indicated that they emphasized that it was a tumor. I have been followed since, and no more symptoms like that, but I do have benign nodules. And I've been followed every 6 months to a year with ultrasound and blood testing. The blood testing has been completely normal. The biopsies have been benign. My doctor tells me that I will die with this, but not because of it.
And your question?
What are the chances of this becoming malignant? These nodules becoming malignant?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think many people struggle with that. And Dr. Misikowicz, could you address that question?
Sure. I mean, so absolutely. So we know that, as was pointed out, that obviously thyroid cancer is a highly curable disease. So many times patients, they have the normal life expectancy, and they don't have this cancer coming back. They never have it. So it's not an uncommon scenario, and probably this is the case. So yes, there are some surveillance tools that we have, and one of them is a sonogram. And many of those patients, they have cysts that are completely benign. Sometimes we biopsy them depending on the features or characteristics that we see on the sonogram. There is actually a scale that we use that we can kind of give you what is the risk that this particular cyst or this particular pathology can convert into a cancer. But in your case, since your doctor, as they say, it is a benign, so probably they are very correct with the statement that they made that probably this cancer will not be back. Yes, if you have concerns, so I would encourage you to repeat those sonograms, because obviously it's not a toxic test, that it doesn't have any side effects, but it's not really an uncommon scenario. When it comes to the risk, what is the chance that this particular nodule can convert to a cancer? As I said, there is a specific tool that we use. It's called Bethesda. So basically, based on the grading, we can kind of give you the percentages. We're using some other tools too, such as age, size. There's some genetic testing. But since the physician that you have is just giving you the term that this is benign, so I would say that probably the risk is minimal to zero.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question is, I'm going to give this to Dr. Sabra. Is there any reason to have a whole body scan, particularly after 7 years of no evidence of disease? Blood work and ultrasounds have never indicated any concerns. Does the WBS find recurrence if blood work and ultrasound do not? So this is a general question. Probably many people on the call have had a question like this as well, but this is if you could just answer this, Dr. Sabra, in a general way, just to be helpful to this participant.
Right. So this is a very good question, and this is a question that we actually get a lot in clinic. In the past, we used to use radioactive iodine scan to help us detect recurrences in patients. So it was not uncommon that after a patient had received surgery and radioactive iodine, then a year later or even 2 years later, we would repeat a radioactive iodine scan and also get the level of a tumor marker under stimulated conditions to try to figure out whether the patient has done well or whether there's any evidence of cancer that still persists. More recently, we have learned that the information that we gather from a very sensitive tumor marker that we obtained by the blood test and also by a very sensitive technology of the ultrasound and some other imaging such as the CAT scan is usually sufficient to be able to detect cancer. It's actually superior to detect cancer than in regard to as compared to the whole body scan. So at this point, we do not see, at least at Memorial, we do not commonly use a whole body scan in our options to try to diagnose disease, unless we sometimes use it in very rare conditions where we have like a tumor marker going up and we did other testing and we're not able to find where the disease is, then we might actually use a whole body scan in that situation. But we do not do it routinely as part of the screening to see if there's any cancer outside of that specific situation.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, actually this will be our last question, interesting question, and I'm going to ask this of Dr. Misikowicz. What rates of future cancers, for example, breast cancer, skin cancer, might thyroid cancer patients need to be aware of? So if you could just address this in a general way. It's a good question, obviously.
It's a very good question. So obviously oncology is going into few directions. And obviously, I give you one example. So the one is obviously the old-fashioned chemotherapy. And old-fashioned chemotherapy basically, essentially, it's a poison that we're trying to poison the cancer. And obviously, we have to find different agents. So this is one way. Second, obviously, it's those targeted agents. So why are they targeted? Because I mentioned the lock, and we have to use the really matching key that's going to be able to match this lock. And we call them TKIs. So we call them tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or eventually targeted agents. The third option is obviously it's immunotherapy today. What we're kind of learning, and this is kind of the challenge for us, we have to learn how to combine those, because we used to think, and I'm referring to chemotherapy, that higher the dose, more toxic it's going to be. Obviously, it's going to translate to be more effective, and we're learning it's not really true. The key is in the very, very careful dose selection. Sometimes you can just give the low dose. So I think the future is going to be that not only we're going to learn those things, how to combine those different modalities to kind of maybe try to find for cure. This is one way. I think the second way, we're learning about those biomarkers. And this was pointed out, for example, with the whole body scans. We used to do them, but now we don't use them because we have some other tools to kind of watch your cancer. So the same thing, we can have certain biomarkers in which we're going to be able to say that for this patient, we should be using treatment A. For the patient B, we should be using treatment B. So it's going to be very individual-based. And the third thing that I would have it in mind, and this is what actually I'm proud of what we do at Sinai for the medullary thyroid cancers. Sometimes we create the model. So we're trying to create exact replica of your cancer. And this replica is put on the model, on the fly model, or for example, on mouse or some other animal models. And obviously having this model gives us the capacity that we can kind of, instead of giving you and testing the drugs on you, we can test those animal models to kind of, before making a decision that you should get this treatment, we can test it on animals. And obviously, this is a very, very evolving area. So I think at the end, I mean, hopefully, we're going to be able to do it quickly and combine all those modalities.
Excellent. Thank you. And this has been an extraordinary call. I have to say, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've all been really outstanding, great, great presenters. I have to say thank you. And I also want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions. And there are many more questions. We could spend the whole rest of the afternoon actually addressing your questions. However, we do have in fairness to all of you, we have this particular time frame. So I wanted to give you information about how to get your questions answered. So for anyone who has a medical question and has still not had that question answered, of course we recommend that you go back to your treating healthcare team. That, of course, is a great resource. But if you would like to go somewhere before that or just get some additional information, supplementary information from a credible source, I do recommend you call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. Or you can visit their website at www.cancer.gov. They have a live chat feature where you can actually chat directly with one of their information specialists. In addition, of course, we've mentioned that there are three outstanding thyroid cancer organizations that you can all access, and their information is in all of your materials. When we send you the evaluation, you will be getting, again, information about them, but the American Thyroid Association, Light of Life Foundation, and Thyroid Cancer Survivors Association. These are wonderful resources for all of you as well to get your questions answered. Now, if you're calling us for support, let's say you need support with some of the emotional or social or practical issues that Sarah Kelly addressed, then I would say you should contact Cancer Cures Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673. Or you can email Cancer Care, visit our website, www.cancercare.org. And there is a place where you can post your questions, and one of our social workers will get back to you. Because we have so many people internationally on the call, or many of you may prefer to pose your question on our website as well. That's another option. Most importantly, as we conclude our call today, we don't want any one of you to feel that you're alone in coping with thyroid cancer or in coping with cancer in general. We want you to know that you can call us at any time, and we are here to help you. We have a very large staff of oncology social workers, and they really are, much like Sarah Kelly, really very wanting to be of help to you in answering your questions. In addition, I would just like to call out to you two programs we have coming up that might be of interest to some of you. One is called Living with Cancer Throughout the Cancer Journey. That's on March 10th, and you'll get information about that program, same time as this particular time. Actually, this particular program is a bit longer. It's from 1:30 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And the other program is Managing Eye and Vision Changes Related to Cancer Treatments, and that's on Monday, March 6th. From 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So we have a bunch of programs coming up that might be of interest to you that are more general in nature, so keep those in mind. Again, I want to wish you all a very fine day, and I want to thank you all for your participation today, and have a great day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.